Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, Maddie plays Thelma to my Louise as we list our top five On the Run movies. And Maddie, I have to ask then, which one of your interns is going to be Brad Pitt?
Grant Branson.
Okay.
I've always liked that kid.
Yeah.
I think he's got the body for it.
Okay.
Well, we got a great show this week. We've got listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Richard Buckner, and the fifth movie in our classic heist marathon, Le Cirque La Rouge.
But first, the following review of Pineapple Express matches up perfectly with Dark Side of the Moon. Drop the needle on your album now.
Why does the studio smell like Matthew McConaughey?
It's been 2 months you've been coming to me, right?
What's up with the suit?
I'm a process server.
You're a servant? Like a butler?
No. I serve out like subpoenas. I gotta wear like disguises sometimes.
Disguise? Wish I had an easy job like you have.
You have the easiest job on earth. You smoke all day.
Mr. Kempinar, stoner films, for lack of a better term, have provided some legendary cinematic duos, Walter and the Dude, Harold and Kumar, Nick and Nora, and of course, the newly reunited Cheech and Chong, the popular stand-up comedy duo who appeared in 10 films from the late 70s to the mid-80s, including, Adam, an appearance in Scorsese's After Hours.
Mm.
And while Cheech and Chong are undeniably unforgettable characters themselves, Cheech and Chong films were not known for their tendency to include much plot. That's plot with an L. Although driving a van made completely out of marijuana across the Mexican border, as they did in Up in Smoke, I think that probably qualifies as leaving a solid cinematic footprint. Pineapple Express, the latest from Judd Apatow and company, includes lots of plot, actually. Screenwriters Apatow, Evan Goldberg, and Seth Rogen have asked the question, what would happen if the stoners actually got off their couch and accidentally got caught up in a gang war? Basically, we get a modern-day Cheech and Chong running for their lives after witnessing a mob hit. My question to you, Adam, do James Franco and Seth Rogen make as memorable a pair as Mr. Marin and Mr. Chong? Will we see them paired up again and again, and do we want to?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know if we will or not. That's going to be a business decision, and I imagine this film's going to make a lot of money, so maybe we will. Whether or not we want them to, I'm not sure I really need to see these two guys paired together again, and I've yet to have the Harold and Kumar experience. I haven't seen either film, and I am a little bit embarrassed to admit that, but just a little bit. I haven't seen a Cheech and Chong movie since I was way too young to actually appreciate pot humor. They'd come on late at night on HBO or whatever when I was a kid, though when I come to think about it, maybe that was the perfect age to appreciate Cheech and Chong. So it is really hard to compare, but you mentioned The Big Lebowski. And I think that's exactly where this movie doesn't quite have it, because there's a very clear case of a leading man and his sidekick, and they're both equals. I mean, John Goodman and the Dude, it doesn't matter which one of them are on screen. If they're on screen together, you love it. They both are fascinating, fun, hilarious characters. And here, unfortunately, you don't really have that dynamic of a duo. I think it's really uneven, because I think James Franco absolutely runs away with this movie.
He's brilliant.
And I know he's got the more stoner role, so maybe that makes sense. But, you know, he really does produce all of the big laughs for me. And you have Seth Rogen being pretty bland. And I actually got the feeling here that he was sort of playing the Seth Rogen character, in contrast to a movie like Knocked Up, where it all seemed completely natural and spontaneous. And I know that's maybe unfair, because Knocked Up was the first thing I saw him. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him in Freaks and Geeks yet, so it was totally new. But everything here with Rogen felt a little bit calculated to me, in contrast to Franco, who actually managed to make that stoner dude character a living, breathing, puffing, unintentionally hilarious person. He's someone who doesn't realize how funny he is, and he's not just a Jeff Spicoli knockoff.
Right. You hit the nail on the head. I am so tired of Seth Rogen at this point. I know exactly. I can predict how he's going to act in every single scene. It's really by rote at this point. He doesn't bring anything new to the equation. It's naturalistic mumbling, you know, kind of throwing away lines here and there, and I just don't believe it. I just don't believe it. And James Franco, as you said, is giving him gold. He's setting him up with softball after softball. Here, all you have to do is play Dean Martin. You get to be the straight man. Give him honest reactions. We don't get that. They drop the ball almost in every single scene. And man, these scenes could have been so iconic. But I challenge you to name a scene outside of this movie that's really, really memorable that doesn't include Ed Begley Jr.
Well, I remember them, I guess, but I didn't actually like the Ed Begley scenes that much.
Right, but they're memorable.
They are.
And I can remember them. But all the other scenes, they sort of all run together outside of the action sequences, which I think are handled pretty nicely. And I like the proposals being made here. I like the fact that there is this choreographed, brutal violence. I like that. I like that there are consequences, that these stoners actually can meet their end here in this film, and we will see their brains on the wall. That's interesting. There's actual real life and death stakes for these stoners. I think Quentin Tarantino probably does that better than anybody.
Yeah.
But if you're going to do that, if you're going to make that proposal and do the violence up, which is funny and kind of beautiful and nicely staged, then you got to bring it in every other scene, and they just don't do it.
Well, I disagree with you on the fact that those action scenes worked. I mean, they didn't work for me, actually, and I feel like
driving the car with a leg through the windshield, that didn't work for you?
That was really funny. No, don't get me wrong. There are some of the scenes that are really funny. I guess I'm thinking more of the last 20 or 30 minutes of the film, which become absolutely cartoonish. There's no stakes to the violence because you don't buy for a second that Seth Rogen is actually fighting Gary Cole's character.
Right.
None of it really makes any sense. People are just dying left and right and getting brutally kind of killed, and it becomes comical and not really in an amusing way. So there, the stakes really decrease for me at the end of the film.
It's lazy. It's really lazy.
That's
the problem is that, look, we would really care how these people met their makers if we got to spend any time with them. But think about all the wasted performances here, pun completely intended probably.
Yeah.
Gary Cole.
I know.
Rosie Perez,
right,
who just hams it up whenever she's out there. They're not given anything to do. Kevin Corrigan is intolerable.
I know.
He's basically just doing a version of his role from The Departed. And I usually love Kevin Corrigan. And Craig Robinson, who is one of my favorite comedic geniuses. People remember him from The Office and, of course, as the bouncer in Knocked Up. I got tired of him here.
Yeah.
I got so sick and tired. I cringed.
He had a shtick.
He had a shtick, and they just ran it into the ground.
They did. Lazy is exactly the word I had in my notes, too. It reminded me a lot of Step Brothers, which you talked about recently during a Maddie's Movie Minute, and I touched on just briefly during our recent After Hours show. But this movie starts out very funny, like that movie, and just loses steam. You have this great premise, but it's a premise that's not really worth stretching out to a feature-length film, and so it does get lazy. They have to fill time. And just like with Step Brothers, we're supposed to laugh at, you mentioned this, Dick Jenkins and Mary Steenburgen, these very kind of proper actors and characters dropping F-bombs and trying to talk street. We're supposed to find it funny when we see Ed Begley Jr., you know, a real straight-laced guy like him, and even then Gary Cole and Rosie Perez go overboard with the profanities. And it actually just made me feel sorry for them that they felt like they had to resort to that, whether it was the lines on the page or that they decided to improvise with those lines. It really is lazy, and the plotting of the film becomes lazy too with the showdown. As I said, it becomes just like every other sort of action comedy we've ever seen. There's nothing really original or inventive about the last at least two-thirds of this film.
And it could have been so much fun. I mean, if you actually think about two stoner characters running away from the mob, that's great. But there's one scene where they're in the woods, and they have to lose their cell phones. Basically, that's the plot device. They have to lose their cell phones. So how do they deal with it? They basically just get manic and start screaming at each other. And it's indecipherable and unbearable to watch. And James Franco, who is great as this Floyd from True Romance character in most every scene, but here he just kind of goes crazy, and then Seth Rogen just starts screaming at him. Now, if you think back to The Big Lebowski, look, these are true stoners. When they get heated at each other, they actually make their valid points. They make their arguments, and it's really funny. They didn't bring it.
It's just not chaos.
Everybody here just didn't bring it to the comedic scenes.
Right, and actually, I want to read a quote from our buddy Scott Tobias from the AV Club. And if you're not reading Scott at avclub.com, you really should, because the lines like this just adding on to what we're saying about James Franco here. Scott wrote, thanks to a TV biopic from 2001, someone was able to convince James Franco that he was the next James Dean. His career has gone accordingly, with sensitive but brooding pretty boy roles in City by the Sea, Tristan and Isolde, Annapolis, Flyboys, and the Spider-Man movies. But Freaks and Geeks fans know that Franco is the inverse, a fake James Dean, someone who uses his looks to score chicks, but is really an imposter and a loser and a damn funny one at that. I think he's dead on there.
No, he's great here. And actually, I'm really looking forward to his work in Milk. He's starring in Gus Van Sant's Milk coming up. I think he's playing Scott Smith, Harvey Milk's campaign manager, because I'll be honest, I thought he was awful in Spider-Man. And that's basically my history with James Franco. But you know who else is great here?
Yes.
Is
Danny McBride.
Yeah. He steals every single scene. Unfortunately, again, you grow tired of him because he's not given enough to do.
No.
That's the thing. There's not enough. Look, comedy, you have to take your comedy really, really seriously, even more so than drama. You can't just go out there and think you're going to wing it. The reason that Step Brothers kind of worked is because you've got Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly bringing it in every scene. At least it's kind of fun to watch them riff on each other. If you don't bring it in every scene and treat every moment as life and death, then we're not going to buy it, and
sure,
we're going to be bored. Danny McBride, at least, he's doing something.
He is.
He's trying something.
No.
The movie just doesn't allow him enough to do.
No, you're right. And there are several funny lines and bits in this movie.
Oh, yes.
I think we both agree most of those are either James Franco or Danny McBride. There are two truly inspired bits, maybe three if you count the first time they go to Danny McBride's house. The action there actually for me was pretty funny, where they get into this fight and just start destroying everything. But the beginning sequence with Bill Hader, it's this military experiment back in the 30s. They're testing marijuana and its reaction that soldiers have to it. I thought that was really funny, and then I hope that that would kind of set the tone for the movie.
I think you're right. I actually think it's kind of endemic of what was wrong with this film.
Yeah.
Is like, because it was nice, it was funny, but all it got out of me was like a hearty chuckle, and it went on a little bit too long.
Yeah, it did go on a little bit too long. And then the end scene, and I don't think I'm giving anything away here in terms of a spoiler. This is an action comedy. The main three characters don't die. They end up together. There's a scene at the end, and I'll just say that their final scene together actually almost made up for the 30 minutes of nonsense
before.
Best
scene in the movie.
It was the best scene in the movie, and unfortunately it was at the end of the movie. But we can't close here without at least mentioning David Gordon Green, because, of course, a big deal was made on this show and elsewhere about the fact that this indie auteur is directing this Judd Apatow film. And, of course, he's had other guys like Greg Mottola, who's kind of in that same vein, maybe not on the level that David Gordon Green is. But, you know, I was hoping Arthouse Adam wasn't going to appear during this episode. I've been anticipating this movie. We both have, because it's an Apatow production, because you've got Rogen and Goldberg as writers. We both really like Superbad. And I really wanted to see what David Gordon Green would do with this material, because he makes such austere, melancholy, naturalistic films. So what's he going to do with this Apatow action comedy? And unfortunately, he didn't really do anything with it.
No.
He's just a hired gun here. He's following the Apatow formula with these lazy, irresponsible characters stuck in arrested adolescence. They have to grow up as the movie goes on. And I just think by the end, I touch on this a little bit, but the movie does devolve into this almost Naked Gun style of action and violence that really wasn't entertaining. And so for me, I sort of love and respect the fact that David Gordon Green branched out of his comfort zone, but watching one auteur take another sort of quasi-auteur, Apatow, and that you definitely recognize his films, and ape his stuff, that really wasn't that interesting to me by the end of the movie. Frankly, I'd rather watch Snow Angels again and feel like blowing my brains out.
Well, the fact of the matter is, I've already said it. Look, I'm going to judge David Gordon Green by what he brings. I'll put this movie up there against his whole catalog. I'm just flabbergasted, completely disappointed by him here.
Really?
Because he didn't bring any discipline. There's nothing distinguishing about the filmmaking at all.
No.
He lets every scene just sort of meander in this stoner pace. It just goes on way too long and wanders all over. As a director, you need to step in and say, no, stop it. This is what we're going to do. Now go here. Go here. At some point, you've got to gain control of the stoners on the set, you know? And he just doesn't point them in the right direction.
All right. Well, Pineapple Express is in theaters everywhere now. Sounds like a little bit of a disappointment, obviously, for both of us.
Our lawyer, Craig Stebbick of Stebbick, Stebbick & Kowalczyk, has advised I read the following. Film Spotting in no way, shape, or form endorses the use of illegal controlled substances, including, but not limited to, Dancing with the Mary Jane, Riding the Snake, or Flogging the Snot Lobster. That said, I would actually recommend not seeing this film in the theater, but wait for the DVD release so that you might be able to enjoy it in the comfort of your own home on your own terms.
Like maybe it was intended? Is
yes.
that what you're saying? All right. Well, if you agree or disagree with our takes on Pineapple Express, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a rambling, incoherent voicemail at 206-203-2463.
All right. Time for a quick break. I must say that your little smackdown on last week's show was extremely entertaining, but alas, only one of you could be right about American Teen. Find out who next in Listener Feedback. Stay with us.
Maddie, this is John from Bradenton, Florida, calling, and I just wanted to say quickly, Maddie, speaking as someone who did graduate 6 years ago in 2002 from high school, the fact that you had the reaction you did to American Teen clearly shows that you are so far removed from high school, so far more than 6 years removed, that you've just lost sight of everything. Take away the cynicism and the hate, you'll see this is a good movie.
Hi guys, this is Ray from San Diego, California. I just wanted to call in and talk about American Teen. I saw an advanced screening of it a few months ago, and Bernstein was actually there at the screening, and I really, really think that Maddie just completely nailed it this time. The entire thing just seemed so contrived and forced. Bernstein actually admitted to reshooting some of the stuff, which is just, I don't know, makes me dislike it a little bit even more.
Hello, Film Spotting. This is Kevin Kraussman, your old buddy. I just want to give you guys some feedback that I thoroughly enjoyed your discussion, argument, review of American Teen. Pull it out for Film Spotting episode 300. That is a classic. Although I did sense the tension afterwards, I'd love to hear more arguments along those lines. Very, very entertaining. Keep up the great work.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. Some wonderful voicemails there in response to American Teen, the film we reviewed on last week's show. And really, Maddie, a perfect primer for the listener feedback segment as we get into the mailbag a little bit later here in this segment, because you have John, who absolutely loved the movie, was on my side. You have Ray, on your side, really didn't like the movie at all. And then you have Kevin, who really couldn't care less. He just liked the fisticuffs that ensued on last week's show. So I think we'll save the responses for now as we get more into the emails later in this segment. We do want to share a few notes first, and we want to mention, as we did on last week's show, that we are having our Film Spotting Chicago meetup on Saturday, August 23rd. If you're in the area or nearby and want to make it out, it's going to be a good time. Actually, Scott Tobias, our buddy from The Onion, who we mentioned in the last segment, he's going to be there. Michael Phillips, unfortunately, couldn't make it, but Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News and some others are going to come out. We're going to have a good time mingling with our listeners, having a few drinks. You can get more information about that at filmspotting.net. You can find the Film Spotting Meetup badge right there above the poll question, or you can just go to filmspotting.net/meetup. And Maddie, I actually emailed your minions last weekend putting out the proposal. You claim to have these minions of interns every week, so I'm wondering, where are you at on my proposal to actually record our next After Hours podcast edition live in front of our listeners on the 23rd?
Done and done.
Done and done. I love your enthusiasm. We will try to do that on August 23rd. Hope to see some of you there. Also, we'll be out and about in the Chicago community just a few days before that. On Wednesday, August 20th, we're going to be leading the discussion of an Austrian film called Forever, Never, Anywhere. And this is part of Cinema Chicago's collaboration with various consulates and cultural organizations in the city to provide free summer screenings of international films to the public. So it's at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 20th at the Chicago Cultural Center, 77 East Randolph Street. If you want more information, you can find it in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. We're looking forward to that discussion. Should be a good time. We also want to mention in the show notes, Maddie, just real quick, that, you know, from time to time here on the show, we do make mistakes.
What?
Yeah, we say things during the show that we really didn't mean or just got completely wrong. For example, a few weeks ago, I implied or basically said that Judd Apatow wrote Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and of course, he didn't write Forgetting Sarah Marshall. The star, Jason Segel, wrote it. And so a lot of times, I just want to mention this, we do actually catch these mistakes before the show goes to air or right after it. Someone maybe notes it. And if you want to go to filmspotting.net and read the notes for each show, a lot of times you will catch these corrections. So, of course, various people pointing out my mistake last week, and I just wanted to acknowledge that mistake and that you can catch those over at filmspotting.net. Also there, we hope you check out our poll questions. And last week, we asked you what you thought David Gordon Green's best film is. He, of course, the director of The Pineapple Express. So here were your options. All the Real Girls, George Washington, Snow Angels, Undertow, Holding Out Hope for Pineapple Express, or Wish I Had an Opinion. Maddie, how did it come out?
Well, a lot of people not familiar with Mr. Gordon Green's filmography, because number one at 52%, Wish I Had an Opinion. Holding Out Hope for Pineapple Express in second at 23%, although please don't hold out hope for Pineapple Express. Number three at 10%, All the Real Girls, followed by George Washington 9%, Snow Angels 4%, and Undertow 2%.
I actually think I ended up voting for All the Real Girls just because it has the great Paul Schneider in it.
Yeah.
And I really like him. And so that's a movie worth checking out maybe if you're looking for a starting point with David Gordon Green. This week, we want to know what you think about Ben Stiller as a comedian, as an actor, a director.
David Gordon Green,
Ben Stiller. Sure. They're both auteurs. Why not? Ben Stiller's new movie coming out is Tropic Thunder. We look forward to reviewing it here next week on the show. And so we want to know what your favorite Ben Stiller movie is.
Is it Flirting with Disaster, Meet the Parents, There's Something About Mary, Zoolander, or he's best in small doses, supporting roles like Reality Bites and The Royal Tannenbaums, and other?
Of course, he's been in a lot of roles. Maddie, how are you voting?
I'm going to have to go, you know, I think Flirting with Disaster.
Really?
It's such a great film. But, you know, Meet the Parents was one of the best film experiences I ever had in a theater. It was opening night. I was there with a former co-host of this show and my girlfriend at the time, and we just loved it. The whole theater was into the movie. We're dying of laughter.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that film. I'm a big fan of all the films we mentioned. Zoolander, not so much, though. Upon repeated viewings, you do recognize a lot of the genius in some of the lines. Some really good bits there. I'd probably go with There's Something About Mary.
Really?
I think that movie's hilarious, though I say that having not seen it probably since I saw it in the theater. I'm not sure whether or not it holds up, but you talk about experiences at the theater where you just laugh out loud a lot. I remember that being one of those. If I had to pick just on the strength of the individual films, though, I might have to go with Small Doses. I think Tenenbaums might be my favorite film of that bunch. I like that older Wes Anderson film, now older Wes Anderson film. I know you're not as big a fan, Matt.
Oh, can't stand that.
Really?
Oh, well, I can't stand that film.
I might go there, but my vote is There's Something About Mary. We look forward to seeing what you have to say, getting your responses. You can vote at filmspotting.net. We're on now to our feedback on our top five movies of the year. We counted down our favorite and our least favorite movies a few weeks ago here on the show. Why don't we start with this one from Jacques, who wants to chime in first on some of the worst stuff.
And writing in from Ossining, New York. You guys continue to inspire me. I know you're big on trying to point out the positives, but I cannot believe you showed so much restraint when it came to doing a worst list of 08 thus far. I have so many, much more worse than best, I am very sorry to say. At number five, he's got Rambo. At number four, Wanted. Number three, The Happening. Number two, Vantage Point. And number one, Jumper. Now, some of his favorites were The Dark Knight, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. In Bruges at number two. And number one, Wall-E. You guys said it all. Amazing, simple storytelling.
I just want to go back real quick to his number one worst of Jumper. Some great comments here. Just a waste, or maybe not. Maybe in 4 years at 1 a.m., we'll be watching TBS, FX, or whatever network picks this movie up and realize maybe Jumper is so bad it's good. On second thought, no, we won't.
Yeah, are you presupposing that Hayden Christensen actually ages better, like fine wine? I don't think so.
I still haven't had the Jumper experience, but I know you have.
Oh,
so
man.
You're in agreement there with Jacques. And we had some other people here, many people actually, in agreement with you about another film that you had actually at the top of your top movies of so far list, and that is In Bruges. We're going to share a few of them here. Brett Sparta Merriman, thank you, Maddie, on In Bruges. Finally caught up with it. I'm putting it number one for the year as well. Great movie. Makes me want to write what I'm already writing better, if that's even English. Of course, Brett out in Hollywood is a screenwriter. Brendan Stark here in Chicago wrote in, Dear Ball Game or Ball Game's intern, my friends and I all became huge fans of the film when we saw the re-release at Piper's Alley. Most of us have subsequently bought the DVD, and I would have never seen it had it not been for you guys. Just wanted to say thanks. Unfortunately, Maddie, there is one listener who doesn't want to say thanks. We have a concerned listener, Candy Nagoo, who writes, too long, poorly timed, cruel and pointless. And this is your best film of the year, Maddie Ballgame?
Yeah, best film of all time, Candy.
Now watch it.
I just want to say these actually are the best emails. I love receiving these. People saying, thank you, thank you, thank you for pushing me to this film. I never would have seen it if not for you guys. That warms the heart.
Yeah, it's great. And we talk a lot about how we're not necessarily trying to tell you how to spend your money here on the show. We want to just have a discussion about the film. But if we can point you in the direction of a movie we really liked, and I liked In Bruges as well, then that is really great to hear that other people had that similar experience. despite there being listeners like Candy out there. Matt Singer, our buddy in New York City, wrote in with his top five.
Number five, quid pro quo. I really admired this very unusual and unusually thoughtful take on the private eye genre. This is definitely the best first movie I've ever seen this year by director Carlos Brooks. I'll be keeping an eye out for whatever he does next. At number four, Chicago 10. You guys each gave this movie 3 stars. I'd bump it up to 4. I didn't honestly know a good deal about this story. Felt I'd learned plenty by the end of it, enjoyed the blend of recreations and original documentary footage. Mostly, I just enjoyed the sort of crazy, freewheeling editing style and music choices that seemed very faithful to the Yippie spirit.
Yeah, number three, Matt has Snow Angels, the David Gordon Green film. Haven't seen it since Sundance 07 when it premiered, but when I saw it, it completely knocked me on my ass emotionally. I was a wreck for hours. Great performances, great writing, and great understated work by David Gordon Green. At number two, he's got The Dark Knight, and I would love to read his comments, but we've put the moratorium on The Dark Knight, though Matt really had some great stuff to say. Maybe I'll include it in the show notes at filmspotting.net. And his number one was actually my number two film of the year, My Winnipeg. I have often used Adam's measure of greatness, how badly a movie made you want to see it again right after it's over, as my own. And for that reason, My Winnipeg is number one. If they told me they were going to run the movie from the beginning as soon as it was over, I would have gladly kept my seat and gone through it again. Hilarious, sad, touching, true, and yet completely false. To me, it's the perfect blend of all the things movies can do in one delightful package. I totally disagree that the hockey stuff was too long. The hockey stuff could have been its own movie. As someone undergoing his own loss of a beloved sporting arena, Shea Stadium, that struck an all-too-painful chord. I've liked the other Guy Madden movies I've seen, but this one felt like a significant step forward for me, the one where he crystallizes his very personal style into something that becomes much more universal. Very well said by Matt, of course, who you can watch Matt Singer on IFC News, does great work there. Really good writing as well.
Matt Singer, the only man in the world mourning the loss of Shea Stadium.
Yeah, maybe so.
Ouch. Brutal. I would like to say Shea Stadium, the area just outside Shea Stadium, is the setting for my number three film of the year, Chop Shop, another film. We're talking about these films that we're sort of bringing attention to that we really are heralding My Winnipeg right up there. Chop Shop, another one. If you haven't seen it, please do go check it out.
It's just like unbelievable. There's so many girls that would give their left boob to, you know, go on a date with him. And he's like so into hanging out with me. Did the orbit of Earth just reverse or something? Did our axis just like tip to the other side?
A clip there from Nanette Burstein's new documentary, American Teen, which we reviewed last week on the show, got into a rather spirited discussion about it. Actually, of course, our voicemailer there at the beginning of this segment, Kevin Crossman, mentioning the tension after the review. Actually, I have to say, there was really no tension at all. It was all in good fun. We had a great time. We actually wish there were more fights, too. Good arguments make for good radio. We'd like to get into more of them. Maybe we'll have a few more American Teens here coming up, but we wanted to share this email to start out with from Wilson Eads in L.A. First of all, let me just say, it's good to finally hear a real argument over a film on your show. I thought Film Spotting could never again live up to its greatest moment, the Lake House review, but it has. Secondly, Maddie, I hate you. You're so wrong about this movie.
Hey, my mom listens to this show.
It hurts. It pains me. I actually want to go back to the theater and watch 3 more showings of American Teen just to spite you. This movie was brilliant. Not only was it brilliant, it was the best documentary I've ever seen. Yes, I said it. Sure, there are more serious and thoughtful documentaries out there, and I've seen
the
major ones. Yes, there are. But nothing made me connect with the characters more than I connected with the characters in this movie. Hannah is a bona fide star. If you like nothing else about this movie, you will fall in love with her. While the basketball player was admittedly a little thin, I was completely involved with the popular girl and the nerd. I just wanted to scream, have more confidence in yourself. The style of the documentary is a little pressing at times, with nicely lit shots of them on their beds staring out pensively, but it fits the style of the movie. High school is dramatic, so it's okay for the director to be a little dramatic in her shot selection, and who doesn't set up shots in documentaries these days anyway? Overall, whether you think the director was heavy-handed in her approach or not, the fact is that these were 4 great characters. I'll be seeing this again at the Arclight soon. If any film-loving young lady wants to join me, Adam, Maddie, actually just Adam, send them my email. So now we have Wilson looking for a date here on Film Spotting, but I do appreciate his feedback on American Teen.
Ladies, ladies, stay far, far away. This man obviously has absolutely no taste.
Ouch.
I mean, that's fine. I mean, look, you bought into this film. You bought into this film. That's fine. There's no way I'm going to convince you otherwise. I think if you like to be manipulated, like Nanette Burstein here,
I love it.
Go back. Go back. You know, stick to your MTV. You know, wear what everybody tells you to wear. Listen to the TV. That's fine. That obviously works for you.
What do you make of the fact that that I haven't watched MTV in about 12 years and yet loved American Teen.
Well, this is which is why we got so heated, because I was so surprised that you succumbed to this thing.
I did succumb to it, though. Why don't you just go ahead and read Luke's response here in L.A., another listener in L.A.
If this was supposed to be a real documentary, they failed miserably, contrived, overproduced, and pathetically transparent. The quote-unquote characters, and that's what they were, not real people, can be heard reading prompted lines and clearly are being coached. The editing was horrible, cutting to a reaction shot to something one of the kids says that was clearly filmed on another day, even in a different room. I mean, really? Even if this was supposed to be a reality movie, they still failed at that. I would have been much more engaged if I were presented with hot, trite, dumb chicks falling over themselves in miniskirts, whining about how hard high school life is. Amen. Luke Passmore, Los Angeles.
I wonder what a real documentary is supposed to be anyway, and my only response to Luke is I'll say that this idea of them being characters is ridiculous. You cannot hear them being prompted with lines or being coached. Maybe they did retake a few things, and that's an interesting debate to get into about whether or not you agree with that in documentaries and whatnot. But the notion that these characters were being told by Burstein what to say is just totally ridiculous. She would never get to make another movie again if that was true, and none of the people involved in the project would be out there promoting the movie or watching it and saying how much they liked it in interviews. It just wouldn't happen.
I don't think she told them what to say, but I certainly think that she edited in such a way that she did. She strung things together to make a narrative, a
just
really
like
manipulative
every
narrative.
Documentarian since the beginning of time, going back to Robert Flaherty.
Guy Madden can do this in My Winnipeg, and it's fun because he shows us that he's doing it. He's showing the falseness around it. Here, no, we're supposed to eat this up like it's real biting material. Sorry.
Okay, well, I went for that biting material, as did Jordan in South Bend, Indiana, with a little response here from the heartland to Luke in L.A. I must say that your little smackdown on last week's show was extremely entertaining, but alas, only one of you could be right about American Teen. As a 17-year-old senior in high school, I found the film extremely telling in how it dealt with the class system that does exist in high schools. It was even more enjoyable, though, because I live about 20 minutes away from Warsaw, and Burstein absolutely nailed the Midwest aspect of the film. I totally agree with Adam here. The scenes with Colin and his father were so subtle and proved to be the most powerful moments of the film for me. Adam couldn't have put it better. This film should be mandatory viewing for every teenager out there.
Hey, the scenes between the father and the basketball player, right. He's got to get the scholarship so he doesn't have to go into the Army. I don't buy it for a second.
You think that Nanette Burstein said that?
Talk about the Army. Of course they
didn't. He's a goofball. He's an Elvis impersonator.
Of course they didn't. He's a goofball. He's an Elvis impersonator. He's joking about it.
He didn't mean it. He is walking a fine line because you see him later talking about the Army.
Yeah.
And he's in a car. You can see his
lips moving. He knows his son's not Army material.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
It's a joke. And of course Burstein puts it out there like, this is it. These are the stakes here.
It's a joke. It's a joke, but it also is legitimate pressure. He does not want to pay for his son's college. I think that comes through loud and clear. So I think it's walking a fine line,
but she didn't have to do that. She didn't have to cut it in such a way to keep reinforcing it. You're right. The pressure is there. We're smart enough. We'll pick up on that.
I love those moments with them. And I just have to say, too, Kamaria in Chicago, she mentioned that she dragged her recently graduated from high school sister to it. They grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I talked about how universal I thought the movie was, and she says it's pretty different, of course, from Warsaw, Indiana, where they grew up, but watching young people that have talent and dreams and ambition have the same desire to get out to do something better, it is universal.
Well, you're right. I thought the moments with Hannah and with the band guy were really there. They were really, really nice. I owed that last week. But ultimately, I agreed more with Sam Cimac here, writing in from Cape Cod. It struck me as an ill-fated concept to begin with. Follow several real-life high school seniors throughout the most revealing, read embarrassing moments of growing up, and mold the project into a documentary-style version of The Breakfast Club. The idea doesn't make sense to me. If a filmmaker desires to create a work that reflects the real American teen experience, then why approach it with the jock, popular kid, and nerd as specific stereotypes? Why push those labels so overtly unless you want to up the drama to distance yourself from that truthful, natural depiction? Director Nanette Burstein throws all sorts of distractions at the screen, animated graphics being the most frustrating, and captures her characters, the use of that word, again, is intentional, Adam, saying and doing things that were very obviously staged, or at least coaxed into a bit.
Or not.
The result is a film with glints of real human drama that's been and buried alive beneath the filmmaker's stilted guise of forced linear narratives and easy conclusions, we're left with a movie that lacks the quick wit of Juno, yet feels no more authentic for it. Here, here, that's basically echoing everything I said, only much more articulate than I could ever say.
Yeah, Sam did a great job there, but where he's wrong for me, where I completely disagree with him, is off the top, where he says that it's an ill-fated concept to begin with. That's where I completely disagree. She very clearly did set out to kind of follow the Breakfast Club model and say, 20 years ago, these were the stereotypes. Do those stereotypes still hold up today? And she did seek out those characters. I don't see anything wrong with that. And actually, on some kind of meta level, maybe, I think it's a brilliant idea for a filmmaker to specifically explore that. So I love that idea. And again, this notion of these people being characters or her turning them into characters, I just don't get that for a second. I don't think anyone watching this film will come away from it thinking that somehow she coaxed them into acting a certain way. Like Jeff in Tulsa, Oklahoma wrote in and said, yes, sometimes people do perform for the cameras. This is something I said last week on the show, but that's not bursting, coaxing them into that. They are performing because the cameras are there, but that's genuine too.
Well, I get that, but I just wish there was something else underneath it. I'm not saying that she's coaxing these kids to act a certain way. What I'm disappointed with is that she felt, like Sam said, the desire to make these narratives, to mold these narratives to, you know, sort of MTV glitz it up, and she didn't have to do that. There is real truth there. Just let the cameras roll. Yeah, you have to cut things together. I understand that. I know how a documentary works. The fact of the matter is I was offended by all the candy coating that she put on top of it.
Okay, and I just call it good filmmaking. I mean, it's slick. It's slick, that's for sure. It's a lot like Brett Morgan in Chicago 10, and they've worked together. They're collaborators as documentarians. You can see that similar kind of style. They're really imposing their touch on the films. It's different than other documentarians. I can see how it could work for some like it did for me and bother others. So that's going to close out, at least for now, the Battle of American Teen. We appreciate all the great feedback. If you have any thoughts for us on any of these movies or any comments about the show, of course, you can send them to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we'll share your top five swan songs feedback and share a few thoughts, I'm sure, on Pineapple Express.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and All Men Are Guilty. They're born innocent, but it doesn't last. Our discussion of the heist classic Le Cercle Rouge. Stay with us.
It's time, 2 days away. I packed up the last and signed my name. Goodbye, my cold and stolen song. Never's never been this long. If you're turning, I'll show you where I've been, and then I'll set it straight again.
Scrounge around and maybe find out what it is that's wrong, and see if ain't something can be done about it. I thought it all out clear, my. I can't. I don't know enough.
Well, how am I going to know about you, Tommy? Why, they could kill you, and I'd never know. They could hurt you. How am I going to know?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. That's Adam. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I absolutely, brutally obliterate and massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard between Henry Fonda and Jane Darwell from John Ford's The Grapes of Wrath, a tie-in with our top five swan songs and DVD releases.
That's true. It did come out on DVD, and as one listener noted, I tried to quickly go through that and pass that as fast as I could. But Jeff Peterson from Ramona, California wrote in, I assume that the connection for The Grapes of Wrath is Henry Fonda, Maddie's Tom Joad. Of course, it was. Henry Fonda was your number one pick for On Golden Pond on your swan songs list. But Jane Darwell, Adam's Ma Joad, also had a great final film role at age 83 in Mary Poppins. Walt Disney personally visited Mrs. Darwell and asked her to portray the Bird Woman for the Feed the Bird segment. I'm looking forward to future performances by Adam using his Ma Joad characterization. Let's see. How about Grapes 2, The Wrath of Ma?
All right. Well, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Carrie Cook from Berkeley, California.
Well, how fitting.
Fitting
for
with
this
Pineapple
show.
Express, maybe just a little. Congratulations, Carrie. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Her mind is blown right now. Hey, that's my name.
Oh, yeah, makes perfect sense, Nick. I just, you know, I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Hey, what about you, Chet? I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block, he's really going to open things up for me.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, but I do want to briefly mention that there was a shortage of entries to Massacre Theater last week, and it may have had something to do with the fact that even though I thought we'd have a deluge of responses because it's such an obvious scene from The Grapes of Wrath, we actually did cut it at the most famous part.
Yeah, I'll be there.
I'll be there. If we had said that, I think we would have gotten a few more. We may have also received a few more responses if I had correctly noted the deadline for entries, which was not July 30th, but actually August 6th. I don't know how much of an impact that had, but we do want to thank, real quick here, Isaac McKeithen in Auburn, Georgia. He actually gave us our scene for The Prestige a few weeks ago here on the show and now wrote in with this idea, at least for the movie. We didn't use his scene. We picked a different one, but he wrote in with this idea tying in with Pineapple Express. So we're going to go with it, and we do want to mention, we look forward to your ideas. Make our lives easier. Do the work for us, just as you do with our feedback and with our top five list. If you've got a great scene you think we should do on an upcoming edition of Massacre Theater, send it to us, feedback@filmspotting.net. We look forward to checking them out. Okay, this one does tie in with the Pineapple Express, and Maddie, it looks like
most
I'm going to start
entered.
It off.
Most entered.
Yeah, because this is obvious stuff here. I'm going to start it off. You give me the action.
And action.
Hi, blank. What's happening? We need to talk about your TPS reports.
Yeah, the cover sheet. I know. Blank talked to me about it.
Yeah, did you get that memo?
Yeah, I got the memo, and I understand the policy. The problem is that I forgot the one time, and I've already taken care of it, so it's not even really a problem anymore.
Ah, yeah. It's just that we're putting new cover sheets on all the TPS reports before they go out now. So if you could go ahead and try to remember to do that from now on, that'd be great.
And scene.
All right, I think you're right. It is going to be the most entered Massacre Theater ever. And if you know what film we did just destroy, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until, and I believe this is correct, Wednesday, August 13th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
Maddie, we've reached the penultimate film in our classic heist movies marathon.
I love it when you use big words like that.
I like it. You're going to hear more in this intro here. And so far, we've seen two British caper flicks. Now with Le Cercle Rouge, we've seen two French caper flicks. And when it's all said and done next week, we will have seen two American caper flicks. Ironically, the movie we both enjoyed the most up to this point, Rififi, is a French movie directed by an American, Jules Dassin. And Jean-Pierre Melville's Le Cercle Rouge is a bleak, unforgiving film noir in the same tradition as Rififi and also John Huston's The Asphalt Jungle. We even get another elaborate, near-silent 30-minute heist sequence that had to be, at least in part, intended as an homage to Rififi's signature sequence. But for the purposes of this discussion, I actually want to start with a comparison to last week's marathon entry, The Italian Job. We both agreed that the film never really asks us to invest anything in the characters. The film exists to serve as an enjoyable diversion, an amusing romp, nothing more. Le Cercle Rouge, one could argue, is almost completely antithetical. Melville, too, keeps us at a distance from his protagonists, the thieves, Corey and Vogel, as well as police inspector Matei. But the overwhelming mood is one of pessimism, hopelessness. The characters derive little, if any, pleasure from their criminal activities and seem to be following a fatal, predetermined path. All men are guilty, the police chief explains, almost certainly speaking for Melville himself. Maddie, were you once again drawn into this rough-and-tumble French world, or were you longing for a little bit of the glamour and romanticism that we saw in Rififi?
I was drawn in.
Loved
it. I really loved it. If The Italian Job is sort of the bustling Technicolor Barnum and Bailey circus, Rififi is the more sort of worn-down traveling circus with the sort of grizzled carnies. Le Cercle Rouge is the rundown carnival sitting on the edge of the pier with a death trap for a midway.
Well said.
I was transported by this film. Just watching it, all of a sudden I felt like you and I could be sitting in a cafe in Greenwich Village and wearing a black turtleneck. Of course, you'd be wearing a beret.
Uh-huh.
Listening to Chick Corea and smoking a Galois cigarette while this movie is being flashed on the wall.
Sure.
This movie just envelops you. absolutely sucks you in. And it's interesting to note that Melville was so influential on Godard and, of course, Truffaut and the French New Wave, whose films then would in turn inspire the new Hollywood. But Melville himself, and you touched on this a little bit when you have Dassin directing a French film, Melville himself was greatly influenced by American cinema. You touched on it with The Asphalt
Houston.
Juggle,
yeah.
Houston and Ford. And this film, when it comes out, it's coming out at the same time as Bonnie and Clyde, as the other new Hollywood films. And I think it's a great European counterpart to those films. Melville is the chess master here. He sees the whole board, and he moves pieces around like he's some sort of cinematic Boris Spassky. Every piece or player in this film is a superstar and engaging in their own right, but Melville uses his ensemble like a master so that no one is bigger than the glorious sum of this movie's parts. I think it's pretty spectacular.
Well, I'm glad you started, because I actually don't know how to follow up what you said. You said it so well. I love this movie too. And I do actually want to quote a listener, Michelle Chepeta. She's in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She's been following along with our recent marathons really closely, sending in some great feedback. And here was her take. Just watching Le Cercle Rouge, my overall verdict is that it's not as economical as Rififi, but it has its merits, and it certainly does. Somehow, actor Alain Delon gives off a moodiness that kept me interested, even when the plot moved along slowly. And she's bang on, I think. Way more deliberate than Rififi. It's actually shot after you get past the opening juxtaposition shots. It's actually shot almost in real time. There's not much cutting here at all. And the heist sequence that we get isn't nearly as suspenseful or as exciting as it is in Rififi. It just plays out.
Because it's not the centerpiece here.
It's not.
The centerpiece is it's the relationships.
It's everything around
it. These relationships that these men had. You've got, you know, we should set up the plot a little bit. One crook is released from prison on the same day that another escapes from a prison train.
Yeah.
And then they meet up in that beautiful opening sequence, which is just great. He jumps into the trunk of the car, but we don't know if he saw him jump into the trunk of
exactly.
the car. And of course, then they have this beautiful standoff.
And field,
you're right.
Yeah.
This is the movie Heat wants to be.
Maybe so.
It is sprawling.
Yeah.
It is epic. He takes his time and he realizes what's interesting here. It's the relationships between and these dynamics between all these different men. You've got the two crooks. You've got the men chasing him. You've got the man and his cats and his relation to him.
Right.
And then, of course, you've got the police inspector overlord basically sitting there judging everybody. That's what's interesting. It's not the heist itself.
No, it's not. You're exactly right. And I have to say about Alain Delon, the star, the more he broods, the more stoic he is, the more I want to watch him.
Oh, dude, I hate to give credit to the French, but they do cool.
We have French listeners.
They do cool really, really
well. They do, and yet what is so cool and so interesting about him is that he isn't cool in any kind of conventional way.
No.
It's not as if Melville is actually trying to wring cool out of him. I think he's doing exactly the opposite, but the more he does brood, the more I wanted to try to figure out what was going on with him. He's an amazing actor, and actually, I haven't seen enough of his work to really weigh in, but he is so good with Monica Vitti, who is one of my favorite Italian actresses, one of my favorite actresses, and also one of my cinematic crushes in Antonioni's film, The Eclipse. And that's another movie full of hopelessness, and there's this overriding sense of dread. But I highly recommend this film to watch Delon as an actor. He is just brilliant to watch. I also think it is a must-see for the influence it's had on other crime movies.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
These anti-noir crime films that have followed in its wake. And actually, if you're a Coen Brothers fan, you especially have to see this movie, because this movie is clearly the template in a lot of ways for Miller's Crossing. I haven't seen Miller's Crossing in over 10 years, which is actually a shame, but the instant that Corey and Vogel are taken out into the woods, out into the forest by two other criminals, I recognize immediately where the Coen brothers
yes.
got the inspiration for the scene in the woods with Gabriel Byrne and John Turturro in Miller's Crossing, the look into your heart sequence. The cinematography, everything about the look of that scene is identical. And then, of course, you start to realize, wait a second, Gabriel Byrne's character, Tom Regan in Miller's Crossing, he's modeled after Corey. He's Alain Delon. The way he wears his coat, the way he moves like a shark, he's unflinching. He's just kind of moving forward
but
the whole time.
Delon is so much more unflappable. I mean,
he is
like Bogart. And every single circumstance, I just love. You know, when these men face off, they know the rules of this world, and they will respect you. But the second you lose their respect, you're dead.
Exactly.
And so it's these standoffs, and you see everybody looking at each other, looking to see who's going to flinch first. And to me, I was really, for a movie that takes its time, I was really on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to watch. And so many of these movies, you said it exactly, the heist is where the satisfaction
yeah.
mainly comes. It's all building up to that. But here, Melville does basically take all the glamour out of it, and he makes his movie about everything else surrounding
it. It reminds me a lot of, you know, Scorsese, of course, must draw a lot of influence influence from this. It reminds me of Goodfellas. The Lufthansa heist is not actually the centerpiece of that. It's more about those guys and their interaction.
Right. It's about the lives of the people, and it ends up being about the mundane sort of lives that they lead. It's really bleak and hopeless, and there's really nothing overly thrilling about it, and yet it's still fascinating in its own way. It's a crime movie that, like I touched on earlier, I think it doesn't try to be cool. It doesn't do that hypocritical thing that Hollywood always does, which is condemn the criminal while at the same time make you want to be just like them. It doesn't do that little dance. It just sets it up and it says, you know what? This movie is going to be about these characters, and they lead really depressing, hopeless lives.
Yeah, well, Hollywood is actually getting its claws on this film.
I know,
it's remaking it.
Supposedly,
Who is so cool? Who is so cool that he could possibly play Alain Delon here?
Of course, Orlando Bloom.
Oh, my God.
I know.
I almost passed out.
I know, but supposedly Alain Delon, who is still with us, is going to be in this version, too.
Just have him reprise the role.
Well, that would I'd like to see that, but I'm guessing he's maybe going to be either the chief or the inspector, or one of the two. I don't know. It depends how old they want to go with it, but that will be interesting to see supposedly Chow Yun-fat in that, as well as Liam Neeson, so I don't know. I'm definitely curious about it. But again, this movie, really, it's a template for these anti-noir films in a lot of ways. There's no femme fatale here.
Right.
You know, there isn't that glorification of cool, the heightened style of it. It really is about these characters, I think, who are just kind of resigned to a certain type of life. And, you know, I really was aware of the fact that it might be the only movie in this marathon where you don't see any expression of joy whatsoever from the characters about the heist that they either are about to pull off or have pulled off. It's not about the future prospects. No. I just need one more big score, and I'm going to lead a happy life.
It's their lives.
You don't get
that. It's their lives.
It's just another aspect of
it. They are fated to do this.
That's
it.
They
are like Sisyphus. Yeah. You know, they just have to go about this mundane. This is my job. I need to do this just to survive, not to live,
right,
not to enjoy.
And you see it perfectly in the moment, actually, when they meet. When he gets into Vogel, the escaped criminal, gets into his trunk, it's just an accepted thing. Yeah. He asks, why did you let me get in? Well, why not? It's sort of, there's no answer to it. It's just, it was meant to happen. Of course, it's the red circle,
exactly.
These two characters coming together with that made-up quote at the beginning of the film.
I love that.
That Melville gives us. So it really is brilliant so far. The French are by far winning this heist movies marathon.
I hate to give them that.
Next week, we'll come back to America, though. We're going to get into Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway, our last film in the heist movies marathon. And we are looking for a name for our Heist Marathon Awards that will follow. If you have any ideas, please do send those in. And of course, the Angry Young Men Marathon kicks off in mid-September. We encourage you to check out our lineup for that on our marathons page at filmspotting.net.
All right, time for one last quick break. Adam, why aren't you popular with the Chicago Police Department? Why aren't you popular with the Chicago Police Department? Our top five On the Run movies are up next. Stay with us.
Oh, sometimes I don't think I'll ever be sure coming back from who knows where. Locked up downstairs. Do you remember what you were thinking?
Time to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. Smart People is out now, the movie with Dennis Quaid, Sarah Jessica Parker, Ellen Page is in that as well, a movie we liked but both didn't love by any means from Sundance. It's out now with audio commentary with the director and writer. It's got bloopers and deleted scenes and interviews as well if you want to check that movie out. And also a movie I am really dying to check out, have been ever since we did see Guy Madden, speaking of My Winnipeg, at the Toronto Film Festival, Brand Upon the Brain. This comes out now with a new high-definition digital transfer. It's got narration tracks by Isabella Rossellini, Guy Madden's on it, Eli Wallach's on it. It's got a new documentary featuring interviews with the director and his collaborators, two new Guy Madden short films, and also a deleted scene and an essay by film critic Dennis Lim. So if you're into Guy Madden or just getting into Guy Madden, this is one to check out. Actually, I think Brand Upon the Brain was his previous film at Toronto that he made a big splash with, a big performance, had like a full orchestra up there on stage, I want to say. So he's all about the showmanship, likes to put on a good show, and I really do want to check this film out. Those movies are both out now on DVD.
Well, it's time now for donations. We want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Chris from San Diego, California. That's a gold member donation. Thank you, Chris. Nathan from Fullerton, California, which I believe is in Orange County. Jonathan from right outside Chicago here in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Andrew in Jamaica, Queens, New York. Matthew in Lansing, Michigan. Paul from Edmonton, Alberta. Joel from Albert Park, Victoria, Australia. I think the continent is just messing with us. They're just making up cities at this point. Rebecca from South Portland, Maine. And Christian from Dusseldorf, Germany. Of course, last week we had a donation from Munster. Not to be outdone, Dusseldorf checks in this week. Mark from Sacramento, California. And Paul from Finsbury Park, London.
The Brits checking in once again.
If we skipped your name somehow, please do let us know. You know, our interns are fallible.
Yes.
And also remember that for every $10 that you donate, your name gets entered in the Film Spotting Hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, surf your way over to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page. It's right there.
Yes, it is. And on our next edition of After Hours, that podcast-only edition, which will now be a live edition, it sounds like, here August 23rd in Chicago, we're going to be reviewing Brief Encounter, the David Lean film. This was Neil Cameron in Oxfordshire's pick. He actually gave us three amazing choices that we had to seriously consider, all three of them. Brief Encounter, Redbeard, the Kurosawa film, and also the Miyazaki film, My Neighbor Totoro. It was really tough to decide.
And what was the deciding factor?
The deciding factor, I'm sorry to say, was time. It came down to the Kurosawa film and the Lean film, and then I looked at IMDb and realized that Kurosawa was 186 minutes and the David Lean film was 86 minutes. I'm sorry. David Lean wins out. David Lean, of course, never known for making lean films,
right,
always making epic films. Here, only 86 minutes. That's the one we're going with, Neil. I'm sorry if you're disappointed that we didn't choose the Kurosawa, but we do look forward to discussing that as our next Listener's Choice review. And finally, we do want to urge you to go over to filmgaming.spout.com to participate in our latest contest where you get to cast Batman 3. And there's already a lot of really good entries in this where we want you to pick a villain and the actor to play him in the next edition of The Dark Knight. Basically, you get to write a letter to Christopher Nolan pleading your case. And the fine people at Spout are going to try to get those entries to Christopher Nolan. So be very persuasive. It should be fun to check out all those and read those winners on next week's show. You have another week to get into this contest. The grand prize winner, they're going to get a hardcover edition of the graphic novel adaptation of Fritz Lang's film M. And the second prize winner is going to get a $10 Spout gift certificate and a t-shirt. Maddie, where can they enter?
They can enter at filmgaming.spout.com. We also have a link there on our webpage, filmspotting.net. And please, just by trafficking filmgaming.spout.com, you are helping the show as well, because they are a great, great supporter of the show, and every little bit helps.
All out to nothing in the way of watching her.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's top five time here on the show. And of course, tying in with Pineapple Express, we thought we would do our top five on the run movies, films about characters who are on the lam trying to avoid someone's capture.
Right.
And we'll get into maybe a little bit more of the criterion we used here. I tried to avoid any overlap with road movies, which is a previous top five we had done here on the show. And it's a topic I threw out a while back when we were looking at the schedule. And then Hans Yerhausen in Portland, Oregon, one of our listeners, wrote in with the idea, and I said, well, you know what? That clinches it. It is a perfect tie-in with what James Franco and Seth Rogen are doing in Pineapple Express, so let's run with it. And Maddie, what's your number five?
Well, my number five, you know, with a nickname like Mainstream Maddie, I'm really reticent to put any French New Wave film on my list, but watching Le Cercle Rouge got me inspired. So, of course, I've got to put Godard's Pierrot Le Fou. I think that's how you pronounce
it. Pierrot Le
Fou. Pierrot Le Fou. I think it's fitting to include this on the list because we're talking about Pineapple Express this week. This is one psychedelic film. You've got all those pop art colors. The leads are on the run, but it's Godard. So it's completely nonlinear. And at the same time, a great examination of commercialism, Americanism, with, of course, some commentary on Vietnam and the Algerian War. And one torture scene in particular that actually is quite relevant to today's discussion on the global war of terror. If you haven't seen it, it is a trip to watch.
Well, Maddie, I'm so impressed. I'm actually disappointed, though. I mean, you're trying to take my mantle here as Art House Adam. I don't understand what's going on.
I know. I don't feel good about it.
Well, I should note that I'm guessing, of course, that Some Like It Hot, your all-time favorite comedy, or one of them anyway, it's in the Pantheon.
In the Pantheon, so it cannot make this list.
Not included here. And again, I did exclude any film that made my top five road movies, which was a list we did way back on the show. I'm going to avoid mentioning those now to avoid any overlap with your list. I'll get into them at the end of the show. My number five, it's my only tie on here, but I do think they connect really well. Bonnie and Clyde, the Arthur Penn film, and then the modern-day version of Bonnie and Clyde, the film that tries to make these folk heroes again out of these killers, out of these criminals, and that is...
Natural Born Killers.
It is Natural Born Killers, and, you know, I think Bonnie and Clyde basically speaks for itself why it's on here, but Natural Born Killers has actually never made a top five on Film Spotting before, at least not one of my top five lists. It did appear in a 6-10 list back when we used to do those top five satires, but didn't quite make the cut. Here, though, I had to put it on.
And you're a big Stoney guy, too.
I do like Oliver Stone. I mean, recently some of his stuff hasn't worked for me, but I really like this film. Everything about it is confrontational and provocative. You've got the everything in the kitchen sink stylistic approach, the violence, the satire. I actually really love this movie and remember really relishing the theatrical experience, seeing it with other people and getting the reactions, gauging the reactions that people were having to the film. So that's my number five.
Well, I just want to react to that a little bit. Both those films I considered, but I did have one criterion. It's for the people on the road had to know they were being chased. Okay. Now, Bonnie and Clyde, by the end, they know they're being chased. But they're also bank robbers out to have fun and kind of nihilistic in sort of the same way with Natural Born Killers. So that's why I didn't include them here.
Okay.
So I've got, of course, at number four, The Fugitive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're going to do a list of on-the-run movies, you've got to include The Fugitive. I mean, Andrew Davis, I mean, I don't think he's done anything of merit since this film, but when you get everything right, you get everything right. And this, he builds the tension in this film, scene upon scene. He never lets up. And I love when a movie doesn't allow you to breathe until the final frame, and I think that's what he accomplishes here.
Very well said. A great pick there. My number four, I'm also going with another classic in the vein of Bonnie and Clyde, one of the great buddy movies of all time, featuring some of the great dialogue of all time. Let's go ahead and hear a scene.
Well, the way I figure it, we can either fight or give. If we give, we go to jail.
I've been there already.
But if we fight, we can stay right where they are and starve us out. Or go for position, shoot us. Might even get a rock slide started and get us that way. What else can they do?
They could surrender to us, but I wouldn't count on that.
Of course, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Paul Newman, Robert Redford heading down to Bolivia trying to escape the law. It's my number four. I don't think that I need to say anything. The dialogue is there.
Adam, the next time I say, let's go someplace like Bolivia,
Let's
go someplace like Bolivia. That's William Goldman's great script
My
number three, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You forget, actually, how prolific Goldman was. He wrote All the President's Men, The Princess Bride, which is based on his book, and, of course, Maverick in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Did not know this. A graduate of Oberlin College.
Really?
A granola hippie like you.
Yes, exactly. And like you. What are you talking about, Mr. Kenyon? Well, it's a great pick. Goldman, a very prolific writer, wrote a lot of great stuff. I want to say, too, he was initially attached to The Right Stuff, but I can't remember if they had some kind of falling out.
He's a pretty noted script doctor,
well,
too.
Well, he is, definitely. I know they brought him in supposedly a little bit on Good Will Hunting, but I just remember William Goldman. He's one of the great writers about Hollywood and about screenwriting. Whenever listeners write in and ask for book recommendations on Hollywood or just movies that have influenced the way we watch movies, if you read Adventures in the Screen Trade or Which Lie Did I Tell, William Goldman stuff, really classic stuff on Hollywood. So check it out if you haven't already. My number three is a movie I want to say, Maddie, that you, if I remember from a recent top five, have not seen before, and now you have a perfect chance to see it, just re-released actually 2 weeks ago. I don't know how we missed it when we did our DVDs, but we did, and that is Dark City. It's out now in a director's cut DVD, the Alex Proyas film. Had a huge influence, or at least I think it had to have had a huge influence on The Matrix, which came out just a year later. Just brilliant visually to look at, and mixing sci-fi and film noir in a really interesting way. I guess the new disc has new effects and a new sound mix. It's overall just a better print of the film, and it has 11 minutes of extra footage that's supposed to be really interesting. And it does also have the two original commentaries that went with the first DVD, including the one by Roger Ebert, who was the big champion of this film, listed as his best film of 1998, and I want to say was probably the only critic that had it that high. Rufus Sewell plays this character who basically wakes up, has amnesia, he's wanted by the police, he's wanted by the strangers, these characters who are similar to the agents in some ways, though freakier, in The Matrix. It's just a really interesting, dark film. I love it.
Oh, great pick. I will check it out. Let's go ahead for my number two and hear a clip.
No, it'll be okay. Stay with us. It'll be okay.
I have to go away.
No, don't do it. Please, don't go.
I must go away, John.
No! No, wait. Wait, you don't have to do this.
Sorry.
No, don't do it. Don't go.
It has to end here.
I order you not to go. I order you not to go. I order you not to go.
Adam, come with me if you want to live.
Hmm.
Terminator 2.
Yeah.
The special effects, of course, are mind-blowing, the action riveting, but I think this film gets overlooked as one of the great buddy movies of all time.
Maybe.
That relationship between John Connor and that big lug of a robot, Schwarzenegger, is great. It's endearing, just as endearing as Turner and Hooch or any of those other great buddy films. I do love that movie.
Yeah, it's great, and I, of course, considered Terminator and Terminator 2 as well, both very good picks. My number two, it's a movie that we actually both had as a number one pick recently, our little tribute to Sidney Pollack. It was both of our number one choices here, and that is 3 Days of the Condor. My gal, Faye Dunaway, again from Bonnie and Clyde. Here she is with Robert Redford with the Sundance Kid, and he plays a CIA researcher. He's not a spy at all, and he's basically forced into this role of international espionage because he's just trying to stay alive. He's trying to figure out who killed all of his coworkers. He happened to be out of the building. It's just one of the prototypes of 70s paranoia thrillers. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's a great, great pick, and one of my honorable mentions. Just missed the list. Well, my number one, North by Northwest, my favorite Hitchcock film. Well, I don't know. Rebecca's really great too.
Yeah.
Man, that's going to keep me up tonight. Well, I don't know which one is
there's
better.
There's Vertigo and Rear Window.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And he's just coming off of Vertigo after doing this film, and I love it because it's kind of a departure because it is playful. I mean, it's suspenseful throughout, and that's what keeps you in it. But it is really playful. Of course, it's Cary Grant, and everybody's playing role upon role upon role. No one knows, you know, who really anybody is.
Similar to Condor in some ways, actually.
Exactly.
A guy being put in a role that he doesn't belong.
Great point. And, you know, we talked earlier about the lack of iconic scenes in Pineapple Express. My God. Every frame here is legendary. You've got the cornfield, you've got Mount Rushmore, and of course you've got that unforgettable final shot. I will say no more.
Yeah, it is a wonderful film. Great pick. My number one, why don't we go ahead and hear a scene from it?
They hadn't found but one set of bones in the ashes of the house, so we knew they'd be looking for us. Kit made sure we'd be prepared. He gave me lectures on how a gun works, how to take it apart and put it back together again, in case I had to carry on without him. He said that if the devil came at me, I could shoot him with a gun.
Well, this is the only case where there was some overlap with my previous road movies list. It was actually just in the 6 through 10. Ridiculous. Should have been in the top 5. It's Terrence Malick's debut film, Badlands, with Sissy Spacek, Martin Sheen. Love them both in this film. Based on the Starkweather killings in the Midwest in the 50s, where you have a 25-year-old guy taking in a 15-year-old girl. And Malick just never tries to explain these people. He just recognizes that you can't. There's no judgment here. Of course, like any Malick film, beautiful cinematography, these really stark shots that just stay with you forever. Just an absolutely brilliant film. My favorite Terrence Malick film. I think you agree, Matty.
Oh, exactly. Hands down. I think he's restrained here. You know, I think he's sort of loosened the reins too much as he's gone on. But you're absolutely right. This is a brilliant film. Martin Sheen is unforgettably fantastic. It would have been my number one, but I discounted it. And the reason is because, again, yes, they're being chased by the law after he commits the first murder, but he doesn't care.
They don't feel the heat.
They
really
don't feel the heat at all. But you're right. Great pick.
Well, let's briefly go through some of our honorable mentions. Maddie, what did you have?
Well, basically, I've already touched on them. The only other one, you know, I like this film, Minority Report. You've got Tom Cruise on the run. There's a lot going on, but I was entertained.
And not all of it works. It's a
decent film.
No,
exactly.
I have big issues with the ending of the film, and also Colin Farrell. Surprisingly, because we did love him so much in Bruges, I actually hate his gum-smacking performance in Minority Report. I think he's a big distraction in that movie. But you really did cover in your list all my honorable mentions. These are movies that all easily could have been in my top five. The Fugitive, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? A little Coen Brothers love there. Wild at Heart, the David Lynch film. Terminator 1, North by Northwest, Leon the Professional, and yes, Rambo First Blood.
Rambo First Blood.
I had to think about Rambo. Come on.
I thought he goes to Vietnam to re-win the war.
Not in First Blood. Not in the first one.
Oh, man.
Not in the debut one. Come on. He's being chased for doing nothing wrong. He's just a Vietnam vet that wants peace.
I really need to revisit that
film.
The
cops cannot leave him alone. And I should mention, listeners, very astute, longtime listeners may remember that North by Northwest was a film that appeared on my top five movies I was most embarrassed to admit I'd never seen a while back. And of course, since that time, several months ago, I have obviously now seen North by Northwest. It is a really good film, of course. Hitchcock and Cary Grant's awesome, and Eva Marie Saint as well. I love in that movie. So it did have to at least make the honorable mentions. I think with The Fugitive, it had come up recently on a top five we did. I'm drawing a blank which one it was. But
TV adaptations.
TV adaptations. So maybe I kind of just put it in the honorable mentions this time. Road movies, though, I mentioned again that we had done this previous top five. My list included Thelma and Louise, Lost in America, Paris, Texas, Midnight Run, of course, we've quoted it a few times here on the show, and My Own Private Idaho, the Gus Van Sant film. So wanted to avoid any mention of those films this time.
All right. Well, those are our top five On the Run movies. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, or actually earlier here in the week, Pineapple Express, the David Gordon Green film. We look forward to hearing whether or not you had a more enjoyable experience with that one. Though, again, some really funny stuff in it. Maybe just not worth an entire film, I guess is one way to put it. Also out, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2. Matt, are you going to be in line?
No.
No? Okay. I do love Alexis Bledel from Gilmore Girls, though I never watched that show, but I will not be checking that
film out.
What
was the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 1?
You missed it?
I did.
Well, I'm sorry about
that. Right over my head.
Also out in limited release, the documentary Man on Wire, played at Sundance. We missed it. We're going to discuss that next week, along with the highly anticipated Ben Stiller comedy, Tropic Thunder.
I cannot wait.
I know.
Cannot wait.
It's going to be great. I recently did have the chance to talk to Steve Coogan, of course, about Hamlet 2. Going to hear from him in a couple of weeks. He's in Tropic Thunder. Couldn't stop raving about Tropic Thunder, so that will be fun. And tying in with Tropic Thunder, we're going to do a Redux Top 5 from the second episode of Film Spotting. We're going to do our Top 5 Movies About Movies. Going to be fun.
Look forward to that. All right. Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Joe Dassault for his great, great production help, and to Richard Buckner and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at MergeRecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
You know what would be great? You know what would be great with what came out on the DVD version of this movie?
What?
You know what would be great?
What?
You know what they need? Is, you know how when you go to 3D movies and they tell you when to put on your 3D glasses?
Mm-hmm.
Think of this. On the DVD, instead of telling you when to put on your 3D glass, they tell you when to smoke, man. They tell you what, you like right now, if you've got some Kava Kava around the house, just feel free at this point to do it. From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
Sounding like a Stone Nicholson?
Listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Richard Buckner.
All right, are we ready?
Born.
Okay.